With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hello and welcome back to the EPL Roundtable. I'm your host, Kevin DeVries, and as always, if you'd like to reach us at the podcast, you can do so by either tweeting us at EPL Roundtable or emailing us at eplroundtable@gmail.com.
Hi, I'm Jay. I'm editor of TheEaglesBeak.com, a Palace fan site by fans for fans. I'm also presenter of the Back of the Net football show on local community radio, Meridian FM, so you can get me on at the Eagles Beak on Twitter or at @BOTNLive_.
Hi, I'm Gito Llewellyn, Swansea City fan and contributor to the Jackcast podcast. And you can find us on Twitter at the Jackcast.
All right, well, thanks so much for joining us, guys. Up first, of course, we have Making the Rounds, where we each have a few minutes to discuss what's been happening at our clubs this week. Jay, we'll start off with you. You played West Ham yesterday. What was your view of that match?
Yeah, we let ourselves down live on national TV, so yeah, not a big deal. No, I mean, returning from the international break, came at a bad time for us, really, because we were doing really well, playing really well, five games unbeaten, got ourselves up to pushing seventh, eighth place in the Premier League, and all was going well. Then we got an injury to Scott Dan, and we actually got through the two games before the international break. Fine without him. We thought it was going to be a dire situation without our best centre-back, but we got through the two games and we kind of thought that we'd get through the international break and we'd get out the other side and we'll see Scott Dan return. But unfortunately, his hamstring wasn't fit enough for him to play yesterday. In atrocious conditions even in South London, that's no excuse for the way we play. We were poor. West Ham did a job, actually. They were desperate to get that 3 points. Obviously more desperate than we were to get the 3 points. You know, they're in a position where, you know, they've struggled at the start of the season and Slaven Bilic did a tactical job on Pardew, really, which is fair play to them. They set up very well. And it's the same old story for Palace. A team comes to Selhurst Park and sets up in a way that, you know, they're not going to lose a game. They've come to get something from the game, whether it's a point, a goalless draw, or to nick a win, and they actually went away and nicked a win. And a fair play to them. The first half, they were better than us. We just couldn't get things going at all. Great goal from West Ham, Lanzini, really well worked. Great cross by Cresswell, can appreciate that. And we could see it coming, 19th minute, and we just couldn't get ourselves going. Anything like we saw before the international break and kind of looked a bit lackluster. I don't know whether we underestimated West Ham a little bit, perhaps. I'm not sure. I find it hard to believe that we would because, you know, West Ham have talent in their side. You've only got to look at players like Payet and you've also got Cresswell came back, first game back after injury. Obviously good to see him back from a West Ham perspective, obviously from a Palace perspective. You know, he played quite well. And an assist for the goal. Towards the end of the first half, we were given a massive lifeline, a penalty, and it was a penalty. I mean, there's a foul on Wolf Zaha just outside the area by Valencia, which played on, and Benteke was taken out in the area, which a clear penalty. And we thought after Benteke's exploits in the European qualifier, World Cup qualifiers even during the week, we thought this is no brainer. Benteke's going to step up and score top, you know, no problem at all. 1-1, of course. He put it high and wide, and I think most of us fans kind of looked at each other thinking, this isn't going to be our evening. And literally straight after that, Benteke almost made amends with a fantastic header. You know, what he's renowned for, rose really well. And I think it just, from where I stand, it looked like Adrian got a hand on it, but I think it clipped the post as well and just went out. So we ended the first half with a bit of a flurry to try and get back into the game. Second half, we played much better. We were the better side and perhaps deserved the draw out of it, but we didn't really create in terms of chances in the final third. We huffed and puffed an awful lot. We had a great chance, header from Wickham, which was saved very well by Adrian in the dire minutes. We had a lot of the play, but we had too many players who weren't really on their game at all. Benteke, probably his worst game for us in a Palace shirt and obviously his young career with us, which is unfortunate because, you know, he's obviously a bit of a linchpin for us, being that big man up front. Kabaye came on at half-time, actually, and really made a difference to our side. And that's something that we haven't seen for a while because he's been on the bench for a lot this season, favouring Joe Ledley and James McArthur in the middle. And we kind of lost the midfield battle by half-time. And changing things up really gave us a bit of space. And, you know, Kabaye kind of exploited that a lot, you know, with his passing qualities and really got stuck into the game. And it's, I think him and Puncham worked so hard to try and create something and didn't really come off. I think those probably are two better players on night. And obviously Steve Mandanda as well in goal did very well. But it was just one of those nights. It wasn't going to come off for us, unfortunately. And, you know, our unbeaten run comes to an end, which, you know, it's disappointing, but, you know, I'm not disheartened, you know, really. It's just, you know, the manner we lost the game, I think there was just too many people missing in the game. And I think it'd be great to have Scott Dan back next week for our trip to Leicester. He will make a big difference to that back line. We are struggling a little bit of fullback about Pap Suare, trying to cover that left back role with Martin Kelly, who's a right footer, and for me, he is more of a central defender. Anyway, so he looks a bit clunky on that in that fullback slot. We tried a young, he's been with us for a long time, Zeki Friars. Kev will probably know Zeki Friars from his time.
Tottenham legend Zeki Friars.
Yeah, indeed, and he made his Premier League debut at Selhurst, but, you know, his first Premier League game at Selhurst, came on at half time along with Kabaye, double substitution. But I don't think he's the answer for that left back slot. And obviously Pat Suare, he's broken his leg in an awful road accident he had a few weeks ago, so he's going to be out for a while. So I expect us to make do some business in January. But yeah, like I say, disappointing loss. It's a game that we should have been looking to win if we were anything like, you know, if we played anything like we have done recently before international break. But we just looked a bit lackluster. It's just one of those games, really.
Yeah, you mentioned Kabaye there and how he's kind of been ineffective and or not playing. Do you think that your hopes this season of finishing top 10 again kind of rest on him showing up the way he has in the past?
Yeah, I think to a lot of Palace fans, he's been quite disappointing since he joined us. You know, last season he came in, marquee signing for us, really, not a couple of summers ago. It really was a massive signing, a player that we probably didn't expect to go out and spend that sort of money on. But we did, brought him in, started well. Great first half of last season, and then just like the rest of us, it kind of faded. You know, the rest of the players, it kind of faded away in that second half. And you know, it wasn't only him, but he was suffering from injury, loss of form, like a lot of the other players as well. I think it was good to see him last night come on in that second half. He, like a lot of players that played in the Euros, seemed to be taking time to get back into the season. Payet's a great example. He wasn't particularly great yesterday again. Flashes of brilliance and different bits like that. But it seems to be quite a few players from the Euros that are probably, you know, suffering from a bit of a hangover from that, whether it's just too much football, I don't know. Kabaye's had a few niggling injuries. But I think he's got to be a focal point for us in this side. I don't think we can play Joe Ledley and James McArthur together, while they both protect the back line, which is great, and it has worked for us recently. Some games it will work for us, but we need to be able to have a different dimension to a game, and Kabaye should be that player to give us that bit of extra dimension. When you've got the likes of Zaha in the team and Townsend in the team to pick out, and obviously Benteke up front as well, I think when the addition of Benteke will help Kabaye a little bit. And I'm hoping we will see him come back into the side, work his way back into the side. I'm expecting that to happen next week, actually. I'm expecting to start instead of Ledley against Leicester next week. It's undoubted quality, Kabaye. He just hasn't shown it enough for us since he signed for us. I'm really hoping he comes through this season.
All right, and on to Swansea. Gitto, you played Arsenal at the Emirates, where you have a staggeringly good record. Don't come away with the 3 points, but a pretty valiant effort, I thought, in Bob Bradley's first match as your manager.
Yeah, it was a pretty mixed game. I'll be honest. It was an entertaining one, but it was a strange one. Like you said, we were quite. I don't know if we can say we were quite confident, but the Emirates is somewhere where we've always done very, very well, even when we've not been playing particularly well. We've won there in the past playing terribly. You know, it's just one of these stadiums that clubs have which they enjoy playing at. And in that sense, it was really a perfect game for Bob Radley because the expectations were very low because we were going to the Emirates. On the other hand, you know, the players do know what it's like to win there. But the first half was disappointing because we started without a recognised striker. And we did look very cagey, quite scared to try anything. The passing wasn't very sharp. And Arsenal, you know, went 2-0 up. And we were lucky to get that one goal back, which kept the game alive, really, going into the second half. The goals, I mean, the first one is a bit of a defensive disaster with the ball is crossed into the box and Amat just stands off of Walcott and allows him basically to get the shot away. The second one is even worse. It's another set piece, the same problems as always, where Jack Cork, for some reason, just misses his header completely. And then Walcott has the easiest of goals. But then, you know, Arsenal gifted us our first real chance of the game, if I'm being honest, when they gave it away to Guilfi and he took it really well. Going to the second half, we thought they was alive. But again, to start the second half, we were just a little bit shaky and deserved to go down 3-1 to a brilliant Ozil goal. But then something, you know, something did click. We started pressing back. We just threw everything at Arsenal, which is probably what we should have done from the start, because everybody knows that Arsenal will always give you chances. And we got back to 3-2. Xhaka was sent off for what? It was just a mistake. It was a definite yellow, not a red. And we were pushing, could have easily got a point, and a point would have been a fantastic result at the Emirates. But in the end, we didn't manage to get it. Arsenal probably did deserve to win it. They were the better team on the day. But there were some positives in the sense that we are still scoring, which is not something we were doing in our bad run last season. We do have goals in this team. I mean, Guilfi got another one. Borja is off the mark now, and you know that the kind of goal that he scored is exactly what we've been lacking. If I'm honest, just a striker with the intelligence to find that space in the box and offer himself up, so that when that cross comes in, he's ready to attack it. So that was very reassuring. There were some other bright spots around the pitch. Barrow, after having his worst game for the club, probably against Liverpool, was our man of the match. He really gave Monreal a horrible time, especially in the second half. And I think Bob Bradley will look at yesterday's game and think, okay, I've got something I can work with here. This, you know, there is talent in this squad, and we've got some nicer fixtures coming up because we have had a horrible run of fixtures. So hopefully, we can build on the positives, correct the negatives, and hopefully now we can start picking up points against the likes of Watford, Stoke, etc.
Yeah, this morning there was an article floating around with quotes from Guilfi Sigurdsson saying that the team is already playing under Bob Bradley. Do you think that's the case, or do you think it's more a statement on how they felt about your previous manager?
I find it hard to believe that they could decide straight away that Bob Bradley is, you know, this great coach. But I think it does say something maybe about Guidolin and the way he was viewed by the players. The impression we all got was that there was a lack of respect towards him among the players. They just didn't respond to him. They didn't rate him as a manager. I think communication was a real issue. Guidolin's English wasn't perfect. And I think some of the players found that quite difficult to deal with. But there is definitely a feeling that the players weren't particularly devastated when Guidolin was given the sack. I think they were pretty happy to see somebody else come in. they, you know, I don't know how much they can tell about Bob Bradley after just, you know, a fortnight of training, but hopefully they are responding to him, and hopefully, they do find his methods more suitable than Guidolin's, because I said this time and time again, I don't think Guidolin was a good fit. I don't think he really suited the club, and I don't think his tactics made the best of what we have at our disposal. So hopefully, yeah, with Bob Bradley, we're hoping that he can get them feeling good again, get them enjoying football again, and actually give them a bit of freedom, if I'm honest, to actually express themselves, which is something, Guidolin probably didn't do enough of in his time in charge.
For Tottenham, we played one of the dullest matches I've ever watched, Tottenham versus West Brom. They continue to be our bogey side. They were one of only two teams last season that Tottenham did not beat in the Premier League, them and Newcastle. So that was this was actually the first time this season we had a chance to pick up points from this exact same set of fixtures from last season, and we failed to take it yet again. West Brom did what West Brom wanted to do, just defend basically the whole match. Got one good chance going forward after Toby Alderweireld had been hurt. They score, of course, Nasser Chadli. I only went basically everywhere that I write or talk last week and say that Chadli probably wasn't going to do much in this game, and he has a lot of tough matchups coming up. And this isn't a revenge game, because he got what he wanted. He got his move. He got his minutes. He got back into the Belgium team. Those were like the three things he wanted. But then he scores against us anyway. And so now I just kind of look a foolish fool. And then Dele Alli gets a late goal. But I was very pleased with the Manchester City result, obviously, when we kind of used that muddled front line. We did not do that in this one. We played Vincent Janssen, who I was obviously very excited to see come to the club. But he is very much struggling to get off to the mark, which has been very frustrating. He plays fairly well. He's amazing at kind of shielding defenders and laying the ball off. But at a certain point, you need to start scoring goals. I think we'll see Son replace him up front against Leverkusen in the Champions League. But there were a lot of kind of pseudo chances, but nothing really hearty until that illegal. And we need to do better than that. West Brom are a top five defense in the Premier League, unsurprisingly. But this was kind of a issue for us last season as well, trying to break down teams that set up to defend, and it seems like we are still struggling to figure out how to do that exactly, especially when they're as well drilled defensively as Pulis sides tend to be. A couple of funny stats that really just point to the fact that they wanted to defend, but West Brom only had 30% possession, and Hugo Lloris, our goalkeeper, had more completed passes than any West Brom player. So just in case anybody was wondering what the flow of that game was like, it was obviously favoring us, but that's fine. They allowed us to have 70% of the pitch. They were just going to set up shop in their penalty area, and it did end up shutting us down. We were without Harry Kane, no Dembele, no Danny Rose. Eric Dier has to come on for Alderweireld when he gets hurt. You can make excuses, but we're still undefeated. We're still in the top three, 1 point off the league lead. The one stark thing, if you look at the extended table, really is how far we are behind in goals scored. But then the defense is obviously incredible and is really our calling card at the moment. So I think we'll be all right. This was a frustrating match. I think we're going to know a lot more what Tottenham's objectives are going to be after we see the Leverkusen match on Tuesday. I think that's just going to really show. If we struggle in that one, we already lost to Monaco. If we lose the match against Leverkusen, I think it's already going to be time to start maybe focusing a bit more on the Premier League. If we win that one, maybe we'll keep seeing the squad split in both competitions. But the biggest concern really leaving this match was more the Toby Alderweireld injury, more than it was a 1-1 draw to West Brom, considering that's their goal every match, knowing that they only need 40 points to stay up. If they get a draw every time, they're only 2 points off. And I think that stat ended up being 36 was actually all you needed on average. But regardless, not too bummed out. The Alderweireld injury doesn't look as bad as some thought it would, although everybody that's talking about this picture that's floating around of him playing video games without his brace on, a lot of times when you have a brace, you take it off when you're at rest. So that's not really as indicative as a lot of people think. But he did not leave the stadium on crutches, which is a good sign. My guess is that he's out for Leverkusen, maybe misses just the match at the weekend, and then is back midweek following. So fortunately, avoided too much of an injury there. The big other injury news is that Harry Kane is going to enter light training this week, probably full training next week before he returns, probably in time for the Arsenal match, which would obviously be a big boost for us going forward.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
All right, now we're going to talk about refereeing decisions a little bit. Don't worry, listeners, we feel your pain. We don't want to have to talk about this every year, but it keeps happening. There were interesting decisions made in both of your matches. The thing that really kind of forced our hand here was the matches today, or Sunday as we're recording, because we had a referee in the first match, Roger East, who failed to make any significant calls, despite the fact that there were many issues that needed to be addressed, followed up by Mike Dean, who seemingly was calling anything under the sun. My question for you guys is, are you comfortable with the level of refereeing at the moment? And if not, how do you think it could be improved?
No, I think it's... I think when there's changes happen across the summer, I think it takes a little while to settle down. There's always a few weeks of uncertainty and referees making decisions that they think is right or are right. Obviously, we have to remember they only get one look at these incidents, and sometimes, you know, it's a very quick... brief look, you know, through a crowd of players, so decisions are made. You kind of see a bit of sympathy with them, but I think the problem we have, Kev, is that you mentioned just now that referees are making different decisions on very similar incidents or interpretations of those rules, and that, I think that's the biggest problem. I mean, we had a good example in our game yesterday. Cresswell got sent off for two yellow cards in the space of 60 seconds, and I said the same yesterday. It's difficult to see when you're live at a game until you actually get home and see the replays of it. It's very hard to make a call or a judgment call from where you are in the stand. However, you have to say Cresswell was probably a bit stupid to make that foul on Zaha, however slight it was, having just been booked. You know, in that position, you just see him down the line. You don't need to be manhandling him. And I just think sometimes footballers don't really have much of a brain in their head. However, the first booking probably wasn't the booking. I think the problem he had there is that he threw himself up in the air when Kabaya tackled him, and Kabaya made contact with Cresswell, and another day could have quite easily been a penalty. But for Cresswell's reaction, you can see why he's been booked for that. But that's very harsh. And again, the second booking was very harsh. The decision by the referee and the linesman was very quick on that second yellow. A lot of the times you watch games and they give players a benefit of a doubt when they make a challenge so quickly. And it wasn't a vicious challenge. Was it a booking? I mean, Alan Shearer said on the TV last night, in no way was it a foul. I disagree with that. It was a foul because he had his arm across the face of Zaha, and it was kind of forced him off the ball and out of play. But I just find sometimes I'm not sure quite what referees see, whether they get caught up in the heat at the moment. And Cresswell's not, he's not a dirty player. I felt quite sorry for him, to be fair. Regardless of, playing against a team and you're trying to get back into the game as, your own team. But I think you mentioned, is it Mike Reid? It seems to be making decisions as close to the rule book or as close to the new changes as possible. I think he's a referee that's been given the challenges in the area for shirt pulling and tugging and you know, different.
He's given the
like
most
that.
Penalties in the Premier League this season.
Yeah, exactly. And that's, you know, maybe he's the one that's doing it right, you know, to the letter of the law. And it's the other referees that aren't kind of sticking to that. He seems to be the only one that's making those calls. And they seem to be. I mean, what was it, the Man City Stoke game? I think it was the first game early, the second game of the season, I think that was. And he made two big calls in that one, which, you know, when you read the rules, and looking back now, those decisions were both correct based on, you know, what a change has been made. But other referees aren't doing it, which is quite bizarre. We actually had a penalty given to us for a shirt pull in the box in the Bournemouth game, actually, which Kabai missed. It's a season of missed penalties for us, but to get us back into the game. And it was a shirt pull, only slight, but it was a shirt pull. And that would never have been given last season, but it was given. I can't remember the referee who it was. I think it might have been John Moss. Can't remember off the top of my head. But yeah, referees are there to be shot at. And I think this has happened before, where a few rule changes have been made in the summer and it takes a little while to calm it down. But it's there's no consistency again, is there? There really isn't at all across the board, referees. I mean, I think we said before we come on air that, you know, it seems to be that, you know, are these referees all in the same meeting before the season starts? Clearly, they must be in different rooms because the referees are making so many different judgment calls. I agree, it's a very hard job, no doubt about it, because, yeah, professional players are trying to get one up on each other at every moment in every game. But yeah, some of these decisions are very, very odd.
No, I agree. In our match, John Moss, who I think is one of probably the most hated referees in the Premier League.
Yeah.
Every single club seems to think he's got something in for them. And that is purely because he does give terrible decisions almost every game. He's just not up to scratch. And I think that's the problem, really. You know, there is a lack of confidence in refereeing ability. Yes, there's more scrutiny of them these days than ever before. And yes, there are more camera angles, so we can see every little mistake magnified and replayed time after time. And that obviously, you know, it exaggerates every failing, really. But I do think the point still stands that referees, we've got a lot of referees in the Premier League who just aren't good enough to be there. I think that's one of the problems. I mean, tomorrow in the Merseyside derby, Anthony Taylor's going to be taking charge. He's one of the ones I don't think is up to it. And with the controversy beforehand about him being selected, despite the fact that he's from Manchester, you know, the potential for that to turn into some massive big deal, it's there and it's obvious. But it's probably what you're saying as well about the inconsistency. I mean, you've got the inconsistencies, not just between different refs, but between different incidents viewed by refs. You said that about Roger East today in the Middlesbrough West Brom game, where Barahan was on the yellow card, and then it just manhandles Success to the floor. It's the most nailed on yellow card textbook booking ever, and everybody's expecting Roger East to go to his pocket and show him right, and he doesn't do it. And then. That's mad enough. But then a few minutes later, you actually see a challenge which is a similar kind of challenge, but not actually quite as blatant. And another player gets a yellow card for it. I mean, that's the kind of thing that really does infuriate you, because obviously the key, what happened there was that Roger East had bottled it. It was gutless. Yeah. Referee. It was a referee that was not strong enough in his own convictions and too scared of the consequences of giving a red card. And that's worrying when the referees are in that, you know, genuinely scared to make big decisions. That's when you really start wondering, well, hang on, you know, how are they actually up to the job here? Because
Guto, do you think that there's a scenario where referees actually think, actually, that player's been booked, so I'm not going to give him a second yellow for that. But whereas anywhere else on the pitch, that a player making a challenge you hadn't been booked would get that booking, would get that yellow card.
Well, that was definitely the case with Roger East. I mean, if it would have been an easy decision if Barahan wasn't on a yellow card already. But But
that shouldn't make any difference, should it?
It shouldn't. It absolutely shouldn't. It's ridiculous. And it's the kind of thing that does anger supporters. And in the end, Watford went on to win the game. It was an awful game, by the way. If anybody didn't watch it, it was one of the worst games you'll see in the Premier League this season. Absolutely terrible to watch.
It was appalling, yeah.
Vile. But you know, Watford went on to win, so it didn't decide the game. But these kind of things do decide games. You know, John Moss yesterday sent off Xhaka. Okay, it didn't make Arsenal held on for the win, but you know that mistake could have easily seen us get a draw. You know, it's not right. They have a massive responsibility, and if they have this kind of responsibility, then they need to be up to the job. And there was a time, I think, looking back about 10 years now, I think the Premier League had the best referees in Europe. That certainly isn't the case anymore when you compare it with other leagues. Generally speaking, I don't think we're up to the same standards.
Yeah. Do you guys think that the better way to kind of narrow this range of outcomes would be just more instruction for the referees, or would you be interested in trying what they've been trying in the Eredivisie, where they've started implementing video refereeing in some matches?
I think that's the way forward, video refereeing, because there's getting to be so much at stake in the game now, and I don't think the players really help the situation by trying to get one over every point in every game. You know, the way the players dive, you know, different things throughout a game you see so many times, and that doesn't make the referee's job any easier. It makes it so much harder than the job already is. I'm not trying to make it sound like your referees don't make mistakes, because they do. I just think sometimes it needs to be a bit more open. I think, you know, when managers can come out after a game and go live on TV and criticise a referee, players can come out and be interviewed after a game and be asked questions about why they missed a penalty and stuff like that. I wonder whether referees should be able to go on TV and be interviewed as well. And, you know, for them to explain to people, well, I made that decision because of this or because of that, and whether that's right or wrong, because players make mistakes in games. They have to explain, you know, in front of the TV camera. Maybe that is too open, but I think video refereeing is, I personally think it's a way forward. It may interrupt games a little bit, but I think it does have to be implemented in a way which is right for football, because football is a game which is generally a flowing sport, isn't it? It's not stop and start like there are, you know, sports in America, like we know only too well, Kev. I think it can be done, but it can be done in the right way. I mean, I think goal line technology was something implemented, which was goal line technology really needed? I still question whether that was something really worthwhile doing, because how many times in a course of a season is that actually used to decide whether there was a goal or not? I just wonder whether it could have been used in a different way for video replays to be done. But yeah, I do wonder sometimes whether there's a view that because it's so easy for a player to be given a yellow card, whether there should be a change to that method, in that maybe there should be three yellow cards or different types of cards. But obviously that adds more confusion, because referees obviously can't implement the rules that they change in the summer to a new season now, let alone implementing something like that. But I just wonder whether it should be more a case of three yellow cards before you get a red card, or depending on, you know, what the offence is, perhaps. But there's so many ideas out there and options. You could be changing things for changing sake. But I think something does need to be done to help the referees a little bit.
Yeah, I don't know what the Eredivisie model is, so I'm not familiar with that, so I can't really comment on it. But I do think it's time to consider expanding video technology in football. Every other sport does it. I think, you know, you can learn from other sports and see what would work in football, what wouldn't. I mean, rugby gets criticised a lot for the fact that video technology slows things down a lot. You find yourself in a situation where every couple of minutes, the referee says, "Oh, sorry, let's go upstairs and check the video to see if there was, you know, anything dodgy there." And so, you know, takes away a bit of the referee's responsibility. But I think when you when you look at, put it this way, I was out in the Euros over the summer, and Wales played against Slovakia in Bordeaux, and there was an incident in that match where Martin Skrtel was trying to sort of shadow a ball out of play, and Johnny Williams was chasing him and making life difficult. And then as the ball is about to go out for a goal kick, Johnny Williams made a run for it, try and keep it in, and Skrtel just steps across him and elbows him in the head.
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah.
And by accident, the stadium showed the incident on the screen, which they shouldn't have, but it drew a massive reaction from the fans. You know, fans were furious, and they quickly realised what they'd done and took it off. But you think if we did have video technology in football, the referee could have just looked up and seen that and said, oh, hang on, we're going to start play, we're going to have a look at that again, and Skrtel would probably have been sent off for that. You know, so it's not something that has to take ages. You could actually have somebody upstairs just checking it back very quickly and informing the referee mid-game, I think you should go back and have a look at this, just to be sure, or something like that. Or even, you know, a challenge system like you have, you know, in tennis or the NFL or something, you know, where say a team has like two challenges that they can have during a game, where they say, okay, ref, we want you to reconsider that with the aid of video technology. And if the referee sticks by his decision, then you lose a challenge or something like that. But it's up to the managers then to decide whether or not they feel it's worth challenging. So you'd only have a handful of cases each match where that would happen. But there are different options out there, and I think it is about time that we do look at these options and think, you know, how these could be introduced to football, because we've got such an amazing array of technology at our disposal. It would be silly not to at least try them out and at least see if there is a practical way of using them without ruining the excitement of a game.
Yeah, I just I'm kind of torn on this because, as you mentioned, Gitto, they should be learning from other sports. But Jay, I'm sure you'll know, there are kind of similar issues in the NFL right now as we're witnessing here, where basically nobody knows what a catch is anymore because they've specified the rule so much that now there's more interpretation. But also, with everything being reviewable, it slowed down play, and it's okay in a sport that's as static as American football, where it's a burst of activity, then everybody has a few minutes anyway to decide what's happening. But in a game like football, it's happening so quickly. Then the question is, how is the decision made? I know you said you weren't sure about goal line technology, and I agree to an extent, but the way it's been done has been done very well, where it isn't stopping play. The referee just gets it on his watch, and it's like, oh, I know we missed it then, but there it is, goal. Like Bentaleb just scored a goal for Schalke this week, where play continued on for 2 or 3 seconds, and then he just points to his watch, points to the spot, and everybody just runs back and you know, restarts play. So if it could be something like that, if it could be more specific, because you don't just want the referee's wrist buzzing all the time. He's like, what's that? I don't know. Oh, be home for dinner at 6 o'clock.
You're so right, Kevin, saying that, because you know, football is such a free flowing sport anyway. You know, during a game, other than fouls and stuff like that, but even that gets going quickly anyway. But it's difficult to compare it to NFL because the NFL is such stop and start anyway. The manner of the game and the way it's played anyway. But it would have to be implemented in a way that would suit the game. Guso mentioned the challenge. You know, that's a very good idea, because they've implemented that well in cricket, for example, and that's been very good because it's down to the team and the captain on the pitch or the player that's, you know, been involved, and they choose to for it to go upstairs. And I think it's 2 each innings, might be 3, I can't remember now, and that seems to work very well because that is such a technical sport, very much very similar to some of us that use that type of thing. But for football, it would have to be carefully implemented, I think, to make sure that it doesn't affect the game too much, but it does affect it in the right manner, if you get what I'm saying.
Yeah, I certainly do. And if video refereeing is the way to go going forward, I think that'd be interesting. It seems to have been going well in the Netherlands. I also haven't yet been able to catch a full match of it in use, but I'll tell you this, if it hadn't worked, we'd have heard about it.
Yeah, definitely.
True.
Yeah, I did hear something earlier on, actually. I didn't actually get the whole interview, but they were talking about a green card. Have you heard anything about that? A green card?
Yeah, in the Serie B, it's for fair play. And like the first one was ever given, I think it was this past week. Yeah. And
that's
right. So it's like, I don't know, like helping up opponents or getting up quickly after you've had a tackle put in on you, stuff like that. I'm not entirely sure how it works. I remember at one point somebody speculating and saying maybe it would like negate a yellow card. Like if you'd been given a yellow card and you got a green card, then you'd be back to like neutral. I don't know if that's actually the case or not. But
if you help an opponent up and get a green card, you can two-foot somebody later in the game and you won't get a red card.
Love it. Yeah.
We'll have to find out more about that, I
think. Yeah, we'll learn more about that before we continue touching on that particular aspect. But I think we've all agreed that, it's not entirely the referee's fault that the rule book has been, well, I'm not going to say we all agree, I don't want to speak for you guys, but for me, it feels kind of like the NFL, where at a certain point, there's a diminishing return on specificity in rules. Because the further crazy specific you get, you have people like Mike Dean, who's following the literal letter of the law, but it's kind of betrays the spirit of it. And then people that are kind of ignoring the literal version, and that's where we get this divide where we have different referees making entirely different calls, which is honestly just unacceptable when, Gito, you mentioned it can be the difference in winning and losing. And then, of course, at the end of the season, that's the difference in millions and millions of pounds. That can be the difference between promotion and relegation from the championship and everything. So it can just these decisions can be massive come the end of the season. And so I think everybody needs to do their best to make sure that we're getting them right. And certainly right now we are not. All right, now we are going to head into Player Watch, where we're each going to have a few seconds to discuss the players that have impressed and disappointed in our most recent fixture. As always, if there was not a player that you thought disappointed, or if there wasn't one that impressed you, you could talk about somebody from the other team that did either. We'll start with you, Jay.
Yeah, I mean, the disappointing game, as I mentioned, but I think the one player that there's probably a few that disappointed me, actually, in general, but I think the one player, I think it's probably happened over a few games, actually, is Damien Delaney. He's not getting any younger. He's been a real stalwart in our team. And there's nothing to say about his commitment to the team in the slightest at all. But I think he's getting to that stage now where Tompkins yesterday had a very good game for Palace against his former team. He's kind of gradually getting himself, he's back to full fitness, which is great after his pre-season injury over in the States. And he's vying for a place in the starting 11, and for me, I think it's only a matter of time before Tompkins ends up being the partner for, or you know, the permanent partner for Scott Dan in a centre back role. And yeah, it's no disgrace to Damien Delaney, because I think when we got promoted that season, I never expected Delaney to last like he has. I thought he'd be one player that would really suffer in the Premier League, but it's been complete opposite. It's been fantastic for us in the four seasons, but it's just getting to a point now where age is catching up with him a little bit, and it's really not helping us too much at the back. I mean, he had a great game the other week. You know, he loves a good block. He's an excellent defender from that respect. But he was getting beaten by header after header by West Ham Zaza, who Zaza's not done anything all season, and he had a really good game yesterday. He was a real pain for the defence, and he really struggled against him. As a backup, he'd be great, you know, for us. You know, to come in if Tompkins or Dan misses a game whenever. But I think it's getting to the point now where that, when Dan's fully fit, that change needs to be made. So, but it is a shame because he's a fan favourite at Palace. He's been great for us, you know, to date anyway. As for the player that impressed, I mentioned Jason Puncheon earlier. Jason Puncheon was fantastic yesterday. He's just one of those players that he was so willing to always go and get the ball from defence, and he was so looking for that killer pass, trying to get us going forward, and just nothing was working. I would say him, along with Johan Gabay, that second half, he came on and he really opened the game up for us, and you know, got us close to getting back into the game, but not quite. But it was probably his best showing for us this season, so hopefully that's good for us going forward as well.
All right, and Gitto?
For the Swans, the one that stood out, probably Modu Barrow. I thought he was probably our best player yesterday, and it's good to see, because he had a horrible game against Liverpool before the international break. He was largely at fault for conceding the penalty in that match, and nothing went his way. He was making terrible decisions. But against Arsenal, especially in the second half, he used his pace fantastically. It made a difference that usually it was just one-on-one, him against Monreal, which he prefers. If he's in that situation, he loves it. He has the freedom. He can go past him, etc. Against Liverpool, they stuck two men on him, sometimes three, and it just killed him. But you know, when criticising Barrow, sometimes we say, "Oh, his end product isn't up to scratch." But you know, he set up the second for the Swans, and set up one or two other good chances, which probably should have resulted in goals. So I thought he was back to the Modu Barrow that we know, and who, you know, gets you off your seat and really gets you loving football. You know, every team needs just a crazy little nutter on the wing who will just run and just take on players. I think, you know, every team needs somebody like that. But in terms of disappointment, I'll probably go for Federico Fernandez. He's not had a good season anyway. He's been making a lot of mistakes. The partnership with Amat just hasn't been working at all. The two of them look extremely uncomfortable playing together. And over the last few games, he's been injured, and Mike van der Hoorn has been in the team, and he's looked far more solid alongside Amat than Fernandez. And it was a very strange decision, I thought, to bring Fernandez back into the team yesterday. And, you know, not only did he have a bad game, and he really was shaky from start to finish and didn't do very much right. But he does also make life difficult for Amat. And he makes Amat the worst player, because Amat had his worst game for a while yesterday. He was at fault for the first goal and looked pretty ropey throughout. I'm not sure why Fernandez was brought back into the team, and hopefully he'll stay on the bench over the coming games, because Van der Hoorn, he's just better in every single way. He's not a great athlete. He's pretty slow, but he's just solid. He'll do the basics right, which Fernandez just doesn't do. You cannot rely on him, sadly.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you a little bit more about Modu Barrow. I was pretty big on him in fantasy circles coming into the week, because he had the second most successful crosses behind Jay's very own Andros Townsend. I know Barrow is kind of on the younger side. What do you think his upside is? Is he just going to kind of always be that pacey guy, or do you think he'll develop into something more?
My gut feeling is he's always going to just rely very heavily on his pace. You know, his end product improved, but it's still not up to Premier League standard, really. You know, the amount of crosses they put in, you know, really, we should be looking at the standards of those crosses. Generally speaking, they're not great. But he's, you know, like he can have games like against Arsenal where, you know, these crosses were finding Swans players in the middle. He does need to improve his consistency with his end product. There's no doubt about that. But I don't think he's ever going to be, you know, a really brilliant Champions League quality or even Europa League quality player. I think he's just your very basic, very good dribbler, got incredible pace. And every now and again, he will pop up with a goal or an assist. You know, that is what he is. For the Swans, he's important just because we lack pace as a team, and he has tons of it. So, you know, when everything else isn't working, you can just pass the ball to him and he'll go and he'll just run it. And, you know, as basic as that may sound, it does make a difference.
Right, and for Tottenham, I'd say the player that impressed played for West Brom. Ben Foster had a ridiculous match. There was a tweet that was floating around the Tottenham circles, and I'm sure fans of other teams will feel the same way as well, but the two best keepers in the world are Manuel Neuer and anyone playing against Tottenham. Certainly had the feel of that today, though Foster has been a fairly good keeper in his day. was able to keep basically anything out that we were really offering. For a player that disappointed for us, I'd say it's probably Moussa Sissoko. Not that he does specifically his job poorly, but it just seems like it doesn't impact the game at all. He'll have some good runs down the right, get into dangerous spaces, but nothing really ever comes of it. And that's getting very frustrating for a team that's kind of struggling to support Jansen in any meaningful way. So would love to see more from him. I think once Dembele is back, we won't really see much of him, just because then it means Ali would need to step up a level in the attack. So he'd probably be in that three behind whoever the forward is. But yeah, Sissoko, he hasn't been the abject failure that I thought he'd be, but he certainly has not helped out the team the way many had hoped. All right, and we actually have a little bit of time here left, so I'm going to kind of put us all on the spot with a match preview of the Liverpool-Manchester United match, if you don't mind. How do you think that one will go?
Yeah, interesting matchup, really. Liverpool are very good to watch at the moment. Good attack inside, although they're letting goals. So as a neutral, they're fun to watch. It reminds me of the old Newcastle team that were close to winning a title several years ago now with Kevin Keegan in charge. Very similar to them. They would always outscore the opposition. And normally higher scoring goals, but would never really keep a clean sheet. United, you just don't know what you're going to get from United. They seem to be a team who one week they would like beat the champions, you know, Leicester 4-0, you know, at their own grounds easily and effectively. And then, you know, that you get the same side that would lose to Watford away, which, you know, no disrespect to Watford. That's games that United should really be winning if they have, you know, dreams of winning a title this year. So I don't think they're going to go that close, really, for me. I fancy Liverpool to win this one, actually. I'm a big fan of Jurgen Klopp. I think he's doing great things at Liverpool. Might be too soon for a title challenge this season, maybe. I could be wrong. But he's doing good things at Liverpool, and they're on the right track. United, not sure whether Mourinho and United are the best fit, to be quite honest with you. See, they spent a lot of money. Not quite happening just yet, but, you know, it could. It seems like an odd mixture of players there. I think they probably need to attend to their back line a little bit more. Perhaps they will do in January. But I'm going for Liverpool in this one.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to this one. It's going to really, I think, tell us quite a lot about both of these sides, because it is a huge game. Liverpool fans must be relishing it, because they probably think that this is as good a chance as they've had in a while to beat Man United. I mean, in recent seasons, I don't think it's been too much fun for them, has it? I think playing at home, and the way they have been playing, especially at home, they could really do a lot of damage to United. The pace in their in their attacks and the movement, it is brilliant to watch. United, it's such a strange one of them, because there was a lot expected of United this season, despite the fact that they, you know, missed out on the Champions League last year. They're suddenly expected to challenge for the title. And I think Mourinho is probably finding that, you know, spending quite a lot of money isn't quite enough. There needs to be that work on a more fundamental basis. I mean, you spoke there, Jay, about the back four. How on earth Daley Blint starts in Man United's back four, I don't know. He's not. I just don't think, especially centre back. I don't think if that's, you know, the kind of player you want playing in your back in at centre back if you've got aspirations of winning the title. For some reason, I am going to sit on the fence and say I think it could be a 2-2 draw. I think there should be plenty of goals. Liverpool, for all their attacking brilliance, they do have big problems at the back. They'll always give you chances. They're far too open. And when you look at the players that Man United have got, you know, that they've got plenty of goal scoring ability there. I can see it being a bit of a crazy one. Hopefully it lives up to the hype, although with the amount of hype there's been, I think that's quite impossible. But yeah, I'll go for a draw and sit on the fence.
Yeah, excellent points being made all around here. Although, Gitto, Daley Blint was in Manchester United's back line for 30 games in the Premier League last season, and they had the second best defense, although it was at centre back. I agree that
they did also have a seriously defensive approach.
True.
Which spoiled their season, really, because they couldn't attack. So he had a lot of protection from midfield last season, which he's not getting this season because they have a midfield full of number 10s.
True. That is certainly true, including Paul Pogba, who's already publicly come out and said that their tactics are too defensive for him to thrive, which is, wow. Isn't this a bit early on the Mourinho clock for players to start complaining publicly? But yeah, I certainly agree with you, Jay, on the Liverpool replicating 2013, where it's all the same strengths, all the same weaknesses. They're going to score a bundle of goals. How many can they keep from allowing in is really the big question. I do think they've made a massive improvement at goalkeeper, switching to Lloris Karius. He, unlike Simon Mignolet, is able to keep out at least some shots that are on target. For those that don't remember, Mignolet allowed 5 of the first 6 shots he faced this year into the back of his net. So those that are like, well, Simulay's a known quantity. He plays for Belgium sometimes. He should be starting. Not so much. So that has improved. Lovren has gotten to be better than his first year at Liverpool, but is still nowhere near his one great year at Southampton. So that must be frustrating for them. But going forward, they're so dangerous, especially when they play Firmino up front, even though it does negate his performance to an extent. It just opens everything else up for the team. We did a whole show about that tactic and how that works. So go check that one out if you want to hear more about that. But I just don't see how Manchester United are going to keep them from scoring. I think that regardless of who they play Pogba with, it's not defensive enough. I love Schneiderlin, but he's not actually a defensive midfielder. I love Ander Herrera and think he's one of the best passers of the ball in the Premier League. He's not defensive at all. And so, Gitto, I do agree with you there that it's just a whole bunch of creative midfielders, which does not offer much protection for that back line at all. And, you know, Manchester United haven't kept a clean sheet the last 4 weeks. I certainly doubt they do so here. So questions will start to be asked about those negative tactics of Mourinho, because it's all well and good when those negative tactics are working and you're picking up 3 points every week, but they've not been. So definitely questions to be asked there. And as I joked about earlier, but seriously, it is a little too early for Mourinho to be in this kind of trouble already. Obviously, if they win, this whole narrative goes to the wayside. But if they don't, I think there could be a bit of an inquisition at Manchester United. All right, and that will do it for us today. So, guys, why don't you tell the folks where they can find you?
Yeah, thanks for listening. I'm Jay. I'm editor of TheEaglesBeat.com. We've had actually a fantastic article. It's really worth checking out if you're Palace fans or just general football fans, particularly Liverpool fans, actually. We've got an interview with the head of sports medicine science at Palace, former Liverpool doctor, Dr. Zafar Iqbal. So it's really good read, so worth checking out. So you can go to TheEaglesBeat.com. You can get me at TheEaglesBeak on Twitter. And I'm also presenter of a local community radio show called The Back of the Net Football Show. You can get me on there at @BOTN_live_.
Follow me on Twitter at Gitto Llewellyn, or if you want to catch up on the Jackcast, you can find that at the Jackcast. We should be recording our latest podcast in the next few days, so that should be going up soon.
Awesome, and I'm your host, Kevin DeVries, at Kevroff on Twitter. You can find my writings at TheEaglesBeak.com. Also, check out the FPL and Championship Roundtables, which you can find both on this channel. Also, the FPL crew, me and Rob Langevin, now do a weekly video for VIP Bet, where we talk about all the DFS prices and matchups over there, where two people that we upped this week were Modu Barrow and Ryan Mason. So that has gone well, so be sure to check that out. I'm sure there are other things I'm forgetting at the moment. Oh, right. These now go up not only on iTunes, but also on a live radio service called All In Sports Talk, which you can find at All In Sports Talk on Twitter and at allinsportstalk.com. All right. Thanks so much for joining us, guys. It's been a pleasure as always, and we hope you keep listening.